Welcome to the Theology on Tap Chattanooga podcast. In each episode, we feature a different lecture given by a writer, scholar, or public intellectual. Each of these talks explores the intersection between theology and culture, and how theology can help better guide us toward the common good of society. These talks are given live at our monthly Theology on Tap events at the Camp House in Chattanooga, Tennessee. For more information and to find out when our next live event is, check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/TheologyOnTapChattanooga. Now, here is this week's episode. We hope you enjoy listening.
Hey friends, welcome back to the Theology on Tap Chattanooga podcast. Today is the second half of a two-part series that we did on trauma and the church. Now, the first part of this series was with Dr. Sam Youngs, and you can go back and listen to that lecture right now. But this is the second part of that with Dr. Preston Hill. And the title of this lecture is In Search of Healing, Trauma in Light of Theology. Preston Hill is the Assistant Professor of Integrative Theology at Richmond Graduate University. His doctoral thesis offers the first monograph-length exposition of the place of Christ's descent into hell in the theology of John Calvin. Dr. Hill is also the co-author of forthcoming book, Dawn of Sunday, in which he really explores in depth this lecture that he's giving right here, and that is how can we create trauma-safe churches, or how can our churches become trauma-safe places for people? So without further ado, I give you Dr. Preston Hill.
Glad to see you all. Did anyone watch the Oscars? Okay, so you're all laughing and smiling. You know what I'm going to say. That's my daughter back there. She'll be screaming throughout the night while we talk about God and trauma. I have never really been nervous about public speaking, but after watching Will Smith and Chris Rock, I'm a little scared, especially because I am going to make every effort to not say anything morally repugnant or offensive to you, such that you would want to come up and slap the speaker. But to try to do that about God and theology and trauma is, let's just say, those desires of moral outrage are never far from the conversation. So with that, why don't we start this way, the way all theology starts and ends. Does anyone have a glass to raise? Okay, raise your glass with me. See what we're working with. Yes, I'm not alone. Two, here's a cheers, a toast, to our one God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, who roars with laughter louder than any of us would ever dare to, and Jesus Christ, his only Son, who has descended into every hell, trauma, every wicked curse of self-condemnation that evil wants you to believe about yourself and your story, and he continues to descend today in every heart who's open to him, okay? Cheers. All right. Okay. This is me, Preston Hill. What about me? What to say? Professor at Richmond Graduate University. I have the pleasure and the privilege of teaching on Christian theology and trauma and traumatology and psychology. And I get to teach trauma therapists about who God is and who Jesus is. And my students are constantly challenging me to articulate what difference theology really makes and what difference Jesus really makes for all this. And that's the best gift that's ever been given to me. I'm also a pastoral therapist. That's a thing in the state of Tennessee. It's a particular kind of licensure that I'm under supervision for, which just means doing counseling and therapy with a view to integration of spiritual issues. Things like deconstruction come up a lot these days. When I first heard that term, I had to look it up. I didn't know what people meant, because I assumed most people weren't familiar with the phenomenology of Jacques Derrida. And that's not why they were coming to therapy, to talk about this French phenomenological philosopher. But I love the world I get to live in. What's the other thing to say? I'm also a postulant for ordination in the American Church, North America. Those are my hats. Anglican, theology, therapy. That's where I'm coming from tonight. Enough by way of preamble. So, two weeks ago, Sam talked to you all about theology in the light of trauma. And the title of his talk was When Doctrine Hurts. And he gave us this wonderful term of theologized trauma. That is to say, when trauma is when theology is the thing that traumatizes people. It's theology in the light of trauma, or theology under the guise of trauma, of this wounding, of theology, people who say things about God that end up wounding us, or things that can be said of God that in themselves aren't necessarily traumatizing, but maybe provide these social structures or the scaffolding, the moral framework within which it becomes possible to harm others by what you're teaching them, what you're telling them God is like. Or through teaching stuff about God, you obscure and make silent the witness of survivors and the real wounds they're carrying. Or you empower abusive structures in the church. What I want to look at with you tonight is trauma in the light of theology. Mine's on. Trauma in the light of theology. By which tonight I'll mean finding God in the aftermath. We saw 2 weeks ago from Sam about how theology can traumatize. What I want to talk with you tonight is not about how theology can heal, per se, but what does it look like for us, the traumatized people of God, which all of us are to some degree or another, what does it look like for us to talk about God? What might post-traumatic theology look like? People who think they're smart like to coin terms. So Sam did it 2 weeks ago, so I'll do it tonight. Theologized trauma is trauma that theology that traumatizes. I want to talk about theology in the aftermath. That's what I want to talk with you about. We're wounded. What does it mean to talk about God in the aftermath of violence and its effects on people? Another way to understand it is with this little graphic. I'm not a PowerPoint person. I'm totally pretending to be a PowerPoint person. I'm posing for you all. Sam has inspired me. He's kind of converted me to become better at PowerPoint. So God and humanity. This is my way of representing to you after 4, 5, 6 years of like master's, PhD at St. Andrews, studying trauma and theology and Calvin and all this stuff. After all the degrees and all the data, it's all a very simple story, isn't it? God is this abundant, superabundant, wide horizon of divine life, light, and love, and trauma is the ground zero of extreme violence, what extreme violence does to people. This is how I like to think of it. I've chosen these terms very intentionally to reflect trauma theory, traumatology, attachment theory, what we're made for with God, what God has in himself, as I understand it. And by the way, everything I'm saying tonight theologically is, I like to do ecumenical theology. I like to say things about God that everyone can say, all Christians can say. So just know the perspective tonight is a broad place. But we are made for trust, empowerment, and delight. Trust, the faith you have in another, being open to another, empowerment, hope, being given the space you need to flourish. For those of you attachment nerds, I'm talking about attunement and containment. And all of that leads to this delightful experience of another delighting in you, and you delighting in another. You're mutually surrendered in love, and you are delighted by your delight of one another. That's called metacognition. I'll give you doing theology and psychology is always a bilingual activity. You gotta shift gears from one language to another. What happens in trauma is this betrayal, this profound betrayal. I trusted you. You betrayed me. I will never be a fool again. The powerlessness. I want you to hear that word. Powerlessness is the opposite of empowerment. Every trauma, the key unifying factor of every single trauma is always powerlessness. Bear that in mind. It's always the event in which you were powerless to change the violence you're encountering. And you feel deep, deep shame as a result of that. And what this creates is fear. Where I once trusted, I'm afraid. Instead of feeling empowered for the union of love, I want to bear my violence and my rage to try to deal with the way I've been betrayed. Hypervigilance, hyperarousal, that's another psychological term for what I'm talking about. And again, the deep sense of this shame. For every trauma survivor, there is usually a very visceral memory of where the shame of the event has congealed. very clearly. Like, this was the thing that... I remember a story of one woman who, she was going to pick up her child and there was a school shooting. And rather than run in to protect her child, she jumped behind a bush to protect herself. And she carried this deep shame thereafter of, what kind of mom, you know, what kind of mom am I? I hid behind a bush rather than running in to protect my child. That shame of that moment of utter powerlessness and fear of surviving that violence. What Dr. Young's brought to us last week, or 2 weeks ago, is the downward black arrow of theology, or what humans say about God, human doctrines about God in the light of trauma, when human doctrines traumatize. What I want to bring this week is I want to turn upward with you. You know, we say in the liturgy, lift up your hearts. People have told us a lot of things about God, right? Our parents, our pastors, our abusers. What's God really like? You know, that's the great, we're going to talk about Freud tonight. You have to when you're talking about trauma. The weird old guy who got some things really wrong, but some things really right. Freud's great critique. We're all just father hungry, right? That's what we're talking about God for. Talking about God is really just about sex. That's what Freud said. Guys, it's got to get weird. We're talking about trauma, it just has to. And you're safe. You're safe. We're safe. We're loved. But you know what? No matter whether we're hungry for God because of wounding from our parents, an Oedipus or Electra complex, regardless of all of that, none of that has any bearing on this question. Regardless of all my beliefs and desires, what is God really like? And I've found over and over again, trauma survivors are hungry for this question, the authenticity and the immediacy of this question. People have told me what God is like. What is God really like? That's what I want to look at with you tonight. When the traumatized theologize, when those who have experienced trauma look to God and see him face to face and see what he's like. Let's try. So that's what we're doing tonight. How to find God in the aftermath of violence. I think we need to do three things for that. Number one, we have to know the nature of the violence we're talking about. So what is trauma? Trauma is a word on the lips of many people, and we often proceed in the conversation without really knowing what we're talking about. Because we think we know. We think we know what we mean when we say trauma. But as one survivor of a Vietnam vet said in a biography published, post-traumatic stress disorder has permeated every corner of our culture. It's a word on our lips that we don't really understand. I want to help us get some clarity on what actually is trauma. If we're going to know how to find God in the aftermath of this violence, that's what trauma is, who is God? Who is God really? I want to give you the best news in the world, which is that the answer is very simple, and it stuns me that Christians don't talk about it very much. We don't talk about the answer to this question that's been given to us by our friends of the past, our dead friends. We need our dead friends. They're great because they don't talk back to you when you're reading from them. And third, I'm going to look with you at how can we create trauma-safe churches, and that's based on the aforementioned book. So first, here's your Latin for the night. You're welcome. You came out to Theology on Tap for Latin. Ex nihilo nihil fit, which means nothing comes from nothing, said by Lucretius, and he was a poet, and Parmenides, the pre-Platonic and Neoplatonic tradition. This is a fundamental insight that the modern philosophy that Instagram and TikTok teaches us today is inviting us to forget over and over again. Nothing comes from nothing. If something is there, it came from something prior. I'd like to add to that, tip our hat to the postmodern philosophers. No one comes from nowhere. And I want to share with you this beautiful, beautiful boy, this beautiful 8-year-old boy. Can you see the resemblance? This is Dr. Preston Hill. At 8 years old, on a vacation to Hawaii with my family of origin and extended family. But the truth of this picture, I had blonde hair before it was cool. That was the only trend I'll ever be ahead of. I'm hopelessly surrendered to being lost to all of them now. But this was a vacation I took to Hawaii with my family of origin, my extended family, and I was taken on this vacation just after my family found out about a member of our family that was also on this vacation that was raping me and abusing me over the course of about 2 years when I was ages eight and nine. And that would be how not to handle trauma. That would be how not to be trauma safe. It would be to invite someone on vacation just after they found out they abused you. Send me to counseling for about a month and then said, hush, hush, let's move on. And I'm sharing that with you so that you know trauma has many faces. You never know what it looks like. You never know who's carrying it. I only am where I am today because I had a therapist who did intensive EMDR and IFS with me. Those of you psychology, trauma, therapy nerds, you know what I'm talking about. And had an intensive arrangement with a psychiatrist who had me on medication. And I'll never forget when I went into his office and he said, my therapist was warm and fuzzy, and my psychiatrist was cold and kind of Freudian. And I actually loved that he was just straight with me. And he just looked at me and said, oh yeah, you have a dissociative kind of state right now. Like, I'm surprised you're not, given the story you've just told and all of this, I'm surprised you're not homeless and like addicted, severely addicted to some. I was like, I remember leaving his office saying, I'm so glad someone was honest with me about this violence and its aftermath. And I'm also morally outraged. I remember feeling outraged at my story for the first time there. But I share that with you so that you know I come to this conversation joyfully affected. Joyfully affected. I want to invite you to it too. To begin to be honest, to name those parts of your stories that, I remember being in your shoes, hearing others talk about this, sitting where you sit right now, and feeling like everyone's looking at me right now because of this story that's being told. Whatever that is that's coming up in you right now, don't minimize it. Just, I want to invite you tonight, I'm not going to go into any details that's going to trigger or harm or anything like that. This is probably the most explicit I'll be, just saying that. But I want to invite you to be kind to yourself and to your story. Evil and darkness always wants us to come into self-condemnation and to a curse. Evil wants us to curse ourselves. The call of God is always blessing and kindness. I hope to convince you of that tonight. Okay, let's turn to what is trauma, the basics. Let's start from the beginning, shall we? This is the late 1800s. This is the man in the center there by the woman is a neurologist by the name of Charcot. And somewhere out in the audience there are Sigmund Freud and Pierre Janet and others who were the early traumatologists who discovered trauma. This woman is having a post-traumatic stress response. She's in an extreme catatonic dissociative state because Charcot, at the time when they were treating these what they called hysterical women, hysteria is what they called it, it's what trauma used to be called. They found out, if I touch this woman near her primary sexual reproductive organ, she starts freaking out. This must be a mental disease that is located in her primary female reproductive organs, hence hysteria. What's a hysterectomy? You remove a female organ. So I want you to hear that post-traumatic stress and trauma has always been allied to gender essentialism, to a lack of political activity to care for the marginalized. I want you to hear that because Judith Herman and Bessel van der Kolk and all the traumatologists today will tell you that advances in our understanding and treatment of trauma have never been possible apart from political action. So be empowered. Along comes Freud. There he is. With his cigar. No cigar is ever just a cigar, he said. Yes. I like to summarize this part by saying there are two Freuds, Freud part one and Freud part two. The early Freud was absolutely wonderful. He didn't have these weird theories that we all laugh at today in the psychological community. He listened to his survivors. He had women coming to him in his office, and he wrote his first treatise called The Etiology of Hysteria, or Where Hysteria Comes From. And he posited, I, Freud, posit that behind all hysteria, there is a history of childhood sexual abuse. Because that's what these women are telling me, and I'm believing them. I'm not going to say that they're just crazy homeless women. I'm going to listen to them, believe them. And then Freud began to realize if that's true, then the bourgeois, high-class Viennese society of respectable white families were all sexually abusing their children, like a vast majority of them. And he said, that can't be true, right? We're clean and sanitized, so that can't be true. And so he said, it must be that these women are inventing fantasies of their own sexual repressive desires. They're inventing these stories because these are repressed early sexual desires. So I want you to hear that Freud, the reason you think Freud is funny and weird, we all look at him that way, is because he stopped believing survivors. Do you hear that? The early Freud knew so much, and he was so good, because he listened to survivors. That's going to be a theme I keep coming up again and again. No one knows their story better than the one who has gone through it. So listen and believe those who tell you the violence they've endured. Let's define it. Trauma. Again, trauma is on the lips of many people. We hear people say, this or that gave me PTSD. I don't want to traumatize my child by whatever it is, not giving them a cookie or something. We use the word trauma today the way people, I don't mean to be offensive, but just honest, we use the word traumatized today the way people use the word retarded years ago. We have stretched it beyond its actual clinical definition because we know it's important, but we don't know exactly what we mean by it. I want to invite you to greater clarity and greater specificity with how you use this word. Trauma is not just a stressful event. Trauma is an inescapably stressful event that overwhelms one's coping mechanisms. That's the best definition I've ever seen. There are many more like it. I want you to hear the key words in this phrase is that there is a stress, there's a threat, there's a danger. Could be combat, could be sexual violence, could be something that doesn't hospitalize you, could be racism, could be something that makes you feel threatened in some fundamental sense of your identity. And you're powerless to change it. That is key for all trauma. It's what unites all experiences of trauma together, as diverse as they are. Inescapable, you're powerless to escape. When that happens, you have the bedrock of all trauma. So here's your brain. This is my favorite way to explain the stages of a traumatic event, help you understand. This is trauma and biology in like 2 minutes. You ready? This is your brain. This is some artist's rendition of your brain during trauma. The blue portion of your brain, neocortex, is associated with thought, deductive reasoning, executive function. It's the part of your brain that makes lists and plans and time and decision making. The limbic system is the orange part of your brain. This is also called the mammalian brain, what we share in common with mammals. And by the way, this whole theory is called the triune brain. It's these three parts that make up our brain. The blue is what makes us special as humans. The orange and the green is what we share in common with other animals. Orange is what you share in common with your dog, which is why you feel warm and fuzzy and connected with your dog. You're not making it up. The mirror neurons in your limbic system are connecting with the mirror neurons of your little friend. It's the part, limbic system of our brain is this part responsible for social organization. It's the part that for me right now is scanning the room and seeing, are these friends or are they enemies? Or what's our social standing right now? That's my limbic system. My neocortex is helping me talk. And I've got those two happening at the same time. Reptilian brain is what's keeping my heart beating right now. I'm not trying to, I'm not thinking about it. It's the part of my brain that just keeps things going in your body. I want you to hear that during trauma, what happens is, the first thing that happens is that the blue part of your brain shuts off. It goes offline. This happens to us all the time. When you're driving and someone cuts you off, what do? You stop and you make a logical list of all the things that you need to do to make sure you don't get into a car accident. No, you don't have time for that. It shuts off and you get into fight or flight, immediate social reaction, right? But the difference is you can swerve and correct. You don't feel powerless to change it. You feel like you can make a difference. What happens during trauma is, I want you to hear these three parts, or actually there's only two here, but I'll tell you about a third for free. These two or three parts of your limbic system start going haywire. The amygdala, that's your scans for danger. Your amygdala scans for danger. During trauma, your amygdala gets really ramped up, and it goes, danger, danger. And my amygdala is the one to me saying right now, snake! And then my hippocampus says, no, these are just wires. I'm safe. All is well. So your amygdala is constantly scanning for threats. Your hippocampus sets you in a story, sets you in context. I know I didn't eat earlier because I don't like eating before I talk to people, but I have some pizza waiting for me at home. So I don't need to worry about my bodily integrity as a human right now. I know there's pizza waiting for me at home. My hippocampus is helping me do that. What happens in trauma is your amygdala goes overdrive, your hippocampus gets shut down. The last thing that happens is your thalamus. That's the third one for free that's not on here. Your thalamus is what organizes your sensory experiences. Stay with me, neuroscience. I'm going somewhere with all this. Your thalamus organ, like right now I can taste the wine that I was just drinking. I can also see you. I can also feel the air and feel the temperature. These are all organized in my experience. What happens in trauma is amygdala gets hyperactivated, hyper-aroused. Matt Busby said to me, how many times are you going to say the word arouse? I said, I don't know. I'm talking about trauma and the body, so probably a lot. Amygdala is hyper-aroused, hyper-aroused. Your thalamus, your hippocampus, hypo-aroused. They're subdued. They're measured. They're off. What does that mean? Well, it means hippocampus is my timekeeper. It sets me in time. I know there's a before, a now, and an after. So trauma now has this timeless quality to it. Why do survivors feel like it's happening again? What's a flashback? It's your hippocampus isn't working. Your amygdala is scanning for danger. Why do survivors feel flashbacks of sensory, distressing, overwhelming sensory data? It's because your thalamus isn't working. And the last thing I want you to hear is, if you're powerless to change the event, your limbic system will actually just begin to shut, and instead of that fight or flight response I was just describing, you'll go into a freeze, a dissociative freeze response. And that's your reptilian brain just kind of takes over and draws in all of your, you know how if you're in the cold, your body keeps this warm, but not your fingers? It's because you're drawing in your resources to protect, because you know you can't change all this cold, but what you can do is draw in your resources to survive. And so trauma literally, I want you to hear this, literally scares the shit out of us because it pushes things out. That's what happens. That's where that comes from, is it pushes things, unnecessary things out of you. That's your reptilian brain playing dead, playing dead. We're like the reptiles in trauma. So one thing I want you to hear is that trauma animalizes us. It puts us in a state of absolute, abject survival. That is less than the rich, robust, interpersonal fullness that we were made for. So from all of this, I just want to give us a few points to help you. My hope here is that you will understand survivors and understand yourself. Survivors feel stuck in the past. The timekeeper isn't working. The past is not the past. The past feels like the present. These are the wounds that remain. They're not wounds in the past. Like, for survivors, they literally feel like it's happening right now, even though they can see it's not. And that's what's so maddening about it. Survivors feel overwhelmed by distressing bodily sensations. The thalamus isn't working. Survivors have no words for their distress. One thing I didn't tell you about is the Broca's area in your neocortex. Your neocortex shuts off. Your Broca's area is responsible for language. Let me put this for you. The part of your brain responsible for language stops working when you're traumatized. So when people don't just have a hard time talking about trauma. The brain doesn't know how to put words to this experience. So stop trying to make them put words to it. That's not the goal here. Even though it is true that you cannot heal what you have not named, that's later down the road. We got to get the limbic system working first before we can move to the neocortex. This is the most important one. Survivors feel pain today just like the first time they were traumatized. There's no difference. When you do an fMRI scan of a trauma survivor having a flashback, it looks exactly like as if they were going through it in the moment. So I want you to hear that. Neurologically, that's what's happening. I want to also draw attention to this. Trauma will always, always, always make us feel isolated and alone. That's a key unifying experience that all survivors describe, this profound isolation and this profound powerlessness. I feel powerless and ashamed that I did not have the power to change it, and I don't feel like anyone understands. So, that's us. That's us wounded East of Eden, traumatized folk. Who is God, really? Who is he, really? And does he really make any difference for all this? It feels so impotent as I put that next part up. God is love. But to quote, who is it who says, I don't think that means what you think it means. Who is it? I thought it was Inigo Montoya. I don't think that word means what you think it means. I don't think God is love means what you probably think it means. Let me suggest something to you tonight. To say that God is love, and again, I'm talking about ecumenical theology from the last 2,000 years, does not mean and never has meant that God has warm, fuzzy dispositions toward us. That might be included in this phrase. That's not primarily what we mean. Some of this comes from, this is my book coming out with, shameless plug. Book coming out with my two co-authors. Scott Harrower is an Anglican priest in Australia. Josh Cockayne is an Anglican priest in the UK. So we're all Anglican ordained or being ordained folks writing about the Trinity and trauma-safe churches. We think the Trinity is important and has a lot to say to what it would mean for us to become trauma-safe places today. So I think Dr. Jones talked a bit about Thomas Aquinas. I'm going to give you a sample of what I mean when I say that God is love and why that matters for trauma. Aquinas famously said that love, this is his definition of love, and I've never found a better one. Love desires the good of the beloved and union with the beloved. Love is composed of these two parts. Can I put that to you in psychological terms? Love desires to contain the beloved, for there to be boundaries and space for another to be who they are, for them to flourish as the kind of being they are. I don't need to own or possess the beloved. They can be who they want to be. They're free to flourish in this friendship, but I want to be one with them. I want to be attuned to them. I want to share in their interpersonal affective states. And that creates love. So Thomas Aquinas was talking about attachment theory back in the Middle Ages, wasn't he? So when we say God is love, what would that mean? We would have to instantly be saying that in God, there is the capacity for a desire for the good of another and a desire for union with another, wouldn't we? Which would immediately mean that there are two in God. Can you have love in isolation? Has anyone ever had love alone? How can we really say God is love if he's only been singular in eternity past? How do you think of, when I say the word God, what comes to your mind? Probably a single individual, right, up in the sky somewhere. That would be a fundamentally either non-loving or the kind of God who's incapable of loving, who needs creation to be loving. Are we saying that when God made the world, think about it, if God has been alone in eternity past, when he made creation, he has to learn a new skill. It's kind of awkward. God's got to learn how to relate to something other. That's a very small, strange picture of God. What if God was, as Augustine said, giving you some European and African theology tonight, from Augustine. I like this picture because it tries to get at what he may have actually looked like. The Father is the lover, the Son is the beloved, and the Spirit is the love between them. When we say God is love, we're saying God is triune. Do you understand that? The Trinity is not a divine math problem. The Trinity is and always has been the Christian affirmation that in God there is the fullness of a lover and a beloved, and that the love between them is so profound that it can't help but go outside itself to have literally make others who weren't there prior just to be able to enjoy it. God is so happy with himself. God's so pleased with himself that he makes things that weren't there so that they can know how good he is. That's what the doctrine of the Trinity is about. And so finally, to draw from three of my other favorite dead friends, Catherine of Siena, Julian of Norwich, Richard of St. Victor, they all in varying ways say this exact same thing. Julian of Norwich says the Trinity is our lover, the Trinity is our maker. Catherine of Siena, I think, quotes Augustine saying, wherever you see love, you see the Trinity. So do you ever think about that? When you've known or tasted someone's love and cherishing of you and empowering of you, that the Trinity is there? Is it possible for someone to be more original than God in their love for another? Do you know what I mean? If I'm experiencing love from someone, is it ever possible for that to be original to that person and to not be some kind of derivative offshoot of the ultimate ground of that love, which is God? Richard of St. Victor gave us one of my favorite points here, which is that if you've been following what I've been saying, if God is love, there have to be two in God, right? Why do you need the Holy Spirit? This is my favorite one. This is my absolute favorite one. Why do you need the Holy Spirit? Why do we need the third member of the Trinity? Why can't we just be binitarian if God is love? Why do we need to be trinitarian? Because we all know the kind of social displays we abhor. PDA, public displays of affection. Two people so enthralled in their love with one another that they're oblivious to the world around them. And what do we want to say to them? You can say it. What do we want to say? Get a room. Everyone always says that when I say this. Get a room. Why? Because I perceive in their love is self-enclosed and not open to being enriched by my presence. My presence is a threat to their love, right? So I need to look away. I don't want to interfere. Isn't it great to know that in Christian theology we're not saying God is like that when we're saying that he's love? We're saying that. Can you believe Richard of St. Victor? This is a medieval theologian talking about PDA. Literally. The Christian faith is way better than you ever thought. And I don't understand why we're not talking about it. Richard of St. Victor says, yeah, God's love is, the technical word is ecstatic. Ecstasis means, ek means out, stasis means standing. God's love stands outside of itself. It's so good that it wants to go out and include others within its embrace. So think instead of PDA like the older couple that you know and love, and you know that your presence is not a threat to them and their love for one another, but that you're safely invited into it. That's what God is like. And actually, they are like God. Do you get that? You get the difference? It's not like those are the real, grandma and grandpa are the real thing, and God is just, that's kind of what God is like. God is the absolute of that. Absolute relationality and self-giving love. And we're just shadowy manifestations of it. So there's my pitch to you of the Trinity and why you should be enthralled with God more than you ever have. What I'm telling you right now is the classical doctrine of the Trinity that theologians have always held. This is strange, right? We don't think about God as triune naturally. We think about God as singular. Are you like me? Did you grow up that way? Thinking about God as primarily just monadic, singular, and that the Trinity is like a problem to be dealt with. So, to Jesus, this triune God who, when he encounters humans who are violent to one another and to him, his answer is to just keep being himself. And that's what the cross is. It's what triune love must look like in a world east of Eden. Self-giving love keeps giving itself, even if we don't like God's love. We say we want it, but we don't. We really want to crucify it. It's very threatening to us. This is me pitching the article I wrote with Sam from The Other Journal. I'm a theology editor for The Other Journal. It's a journal of theology and culture published by the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology. Sam and I did like this joint string of articles. Mine was this: When Jesus Doubted God, Perspectives from Calvin on Post-Traumatic Faith. Trying to begin to answer some of this question of, if what I've just told you is what God is like, and trauma is what it is, what would it mean to have post-traumatic faith? What would it mean to relate to God in the aftermath? What if God has already shown us the shape that relating to God takes in the aftermath of violence? What if Jesus Christ is God's promise to us that he has already related to himself properly in trauma? What if God knows what it's like in the person of Jesus? What if God knows what it's like to fear God, to be angry at God, to doubt and despair of God's goodness? These are lessons I learned from Calvin. Calvin says that Jesus doubted his own salvation. Have you ever doubted your own salvation? Did you ever think God's morally perfect, sinless son would doubt his salvation? Calvin says that Jesus despaired of God's goodness. Calvin says that Jesus doubted and despaired, but we often think that doubt and despair are the opposite of faith. But they can't be, can they? Think about it. Just think about it. Faith and doubt can't actually be opposites. What's happening when you're doubting God? You're angry at God. You've been through something that you rightly recognize to be morally reprehensible. And you're angry at God. And you doubt whether God is good or whether God is near. What are you doubting? You're doubting something that you used to believe, or in some level still believe or want to believe. If you really had no faith, you'd just be a happy atheist, wouldn't you? Right? You wouldn't have a struggle in your relationship with God. Doubt is not the opposite of faith. Doubt presupposes faith. And as Teresa of Lisieux and Catherine of Siena and others I was quoting earlier have all said, even the desire to desire God, they even go to the third level, to want to have faith in God, is an act of faith. God just needs a mustard seed. We don't need to stop beating yourself up and recognize that if you're doubting God, you already have faith. You have to. If you didn't, you wouldn't be worried. Are you worried in your relationship with God? Good. Then that means you've got a bond of faith with God. So stop worrying about it. And by the way, God himself incarnate had the same experience in Jesus Christ. God knows what it's like to doubt God. My God, why have you forsaken me? And you want some icing on the cake? The person who told me that is none other than John Calvin. I mean, it's stunning, the history of theology. If you stop reading secondary sources and you start reading primary sources, you'll never believe it. It's the great lie. It's what C.S. Lewis, I remember C.S. Lewis telling me, dead friends telling me, like we were talking, reading C.S. Lewis say, people, you're not idiots. You think you can't, I could never read a primary source. I could never read Anselm or Augustine or Aquinas. The truth is they're easier to read than all the people who try to explain them on the book market today. I'm running out of time. We'll have to press ahead. How might we begin creating trauma-safe churches? Earlier I said that trauma leaves us isolated and powerless. No one understands me because I can't even communicate this trauma. I'm alone, and I was powerless to change this event. Triune and incarnate love will always, always accompany and empower us. The opposite of trauma is always witness and testimony to reduce the stigma and the isolation. I need witnesses. I need to not be alone. And I need someone to empower me, to not treat me like a project. I need someone to come alongside and say, how can I join you in your journey? I trust you with your story. I don't think I need to own it. The three core experiences of all trauma is that you are threatened by violence, you're powerless to escape, and you have deep shame for the manner of survival. The three core experiences of recovery will always be safety and stabilization. You're no longer threatened. So if someone is still being traumatized, you can't get recovery or healing. You have to stop being traumatized before you can engage recovery. Empowerment and restoring agency. Trauma always leaves us feeling powerless. I couldn't change the event, and that's why those things in my brain happen. Empowerment is always the first step. If someone doesn't feel like they have ownership or power over their own story, you'll just re-traumatize them. Testimony and witness to reduce the isolation and stigma. This comes from the book, Four Principles of a Trauma-Safe Church. We did a lot of searching and hunting and reading and thinking and talking, and these are what we came up with. And we are putting forward the thesis in this book that there may be more that need to be added, but we think that any church that doesn't have these four elements will not be trauma safe. That's a big statement, but we really do believe it. Above all, do no harm. This is obvious. This is just to call a church a Hippocratic church. Hippocratic oath. Physicians, therapists take it. Above all, do no harm. What does that mean, really, other than I'm sure most churches would say we don't want to do harm to people, right? I don't think there's any churches that advertise we want to be harmful churches. What it means, really, is that trauma-safe churches never value the social image of their ministry above the safety of their members. We value image over truth. Whenever moral failing happens at the hands of our ministry, the fact that we call it moral failing or a scandal, we're minimizing the harm. We're not being honest about it. Sexual abuse, say it out loud. That's what it is that these leaders are doing. It's not a moral failing. When this happens, we have to expose these horrors without condition, without apology, without timidity, and with all haste. 1 John 1, God is light, in him is no darkness at all. If we say we have fellowship while we're walking in darkness, we lie. We don't know what's true. Trauma-safe churches are never shy to bring darkness to light, even if that may ruin the reputation of our church or our finances. The safety of our members is always more important. And I want to be clear here that the defense, this is what you'll often hear from people. It might ruin our public witness, right? If we talk about how our leaders are hurting others. That's great worldly wisdom. It really is. The problem is just not what Jesus said in John 13 and in 1 John 3. The defense that this might ruin our public witness is no good reply, because John 13, by this everyone will know that you're my disciples. How will everyone know you're my disciples? If you have love for one another. What does 1 John 3 say? If God's love abides in anyone who has the... How does God's love abide in anyone who has the world's good and sees a brother or sister in need and yet refuses to help? You got the equation right there. Refusing to stand up for the vulnerable and the least and the lost is the worst way to ruin our public witness. In fact, the best way, it's not just okay for our public witness, the best way to bear witness to Christ is to call out injustice. And we can't keep it in the family. It's by public action that we bear witness, right? This isn't for us. This is public action making it possible. The second, listen to survivors with a compassionate witness. When I say listen, I mean listen, go to a helping skills class at Richmond. Listen, develop listening, empathy, like helpful listening skills, attentive listening. Listen to someone and don't rush to stop them because it brings up anxiety in you. Think about your own counter-transference in that moment. Be cautious about yourself. The desire to quickly jump in and agree or quickly jump in and say, I'm so sorry, is just part of our own anxiety trying to shut someone else's testimony down. Look in yourself for the ways you're uncomfortable through the witness of survivors of violence. And be curious about why you don't want to hear their testimony. This requires honesty. It's painful. It's hard. But I want to say also that listening to survivors with a compassionate witness means that we not only listen to them, but we believe them. And you'll hear this. That's one of the most important things for trauma survivors is to not just listen, but to believe. We don't want to patronize. We don't want to say, I hear you, but I know better than you, effectively, with our response. We want to say, I hear you and I believe you. And I think what this means is that trauma-safe churches never value the freedom of one person over the safety of another. And what I mean by that is, if you have an accusation of abuse, you don't adopt the principle innocent until proven guilty. That applies in a court of law, but it does not apply when you're trying to take care of people who are vulnerable to maltreatment. It is always better to be safe than sorry. Always. Always better to be safe than sorry. So for example, if someone says, Preston, look out, and they throw, what do you want them to throw at me? A frisbee. They throw a frisbee at me, and I cower and cover with my hands, but they didn't actually throw it. They were just faking me out. Am I so upset that I covered myself? No, I'm glad I did, because I would have been protected. The same is true. If someone brings an allegation, you always act as if it's true until you have more information. Always. We won't be safe unless we do that. Some of this is what I shared during a white paper at a ACNA meeting, and a lot of people loved it, but I was also a little worried about how it would come over. The third principle is, this one's really important. It is not enough to listen. We have to do something about it. And the thing we do is restorative action. This is a technical term. It's an internationally recognized method of peacemaking. And it is a very basic principle. Like they use this in apartheid stuff. Restorative practice is very simple. You don't do something to or for people. You do things with people. I do things with you, not to or for you. And so when you come to a survivor, you don't say, I need to help you. I'm the healer and you're the wounded. And you don't say, again, no one ever says this, but this is the posture of how they approach it. What you say is, I'd like to negotiate this with you. There are no experts here. You don't need to be an expert for survivors. You just need to be willing to be curious with them about empowering them and joining them. Say to them, how can I empower you for your journey? And if you're threatened by their answer to that, that says more about you than them. The fourth, Judith Herman, a trauma psychiatrist back in the 90s, she was the first one to make trauma popular. And she said it before Bessel van der Kolk did. But Bessel van der Kolk is right. The body keeps the score of trauma. The way she said it is, trauma recovery always begins with safety. Safety always begins with the body. Because you and I learn to feel safe in our bodies before we ever learn to do it logically or linguistically. People need to feel safe in their bodies. Bring calm, bring soothing, give them space, empower them for... Trauma makes us feel like hyper-aroused and hyper-vigilant, scanning for threats. So bring about a calm for people. How can you do that? I don't know, get creative. But it's not just bringing a sense of calm, because actually if all you do is bring a sense of calm to someone's body, that can feel like the powerlessness of the original trauma, and it can accidentally re-traumatize them. We need to also help people learn to fight again. So good. It's so good. Help people get the blood pumping. Help them re-experience and get back into it. And what would it be like if you didn't freeze? What would it be like if you fight or flee? What would that feel like? So a lot of trauma survivors, big into exercise, endorphins, martial arts, liturgy. Oh my God. To come to church and to know, I don't have to know what to do with my body. There's a structure. Right? It's not just a free-for-all, there's a structure here. It feels so safe and guided and empowering. Liturgy and lament. And by the way, lament has become kind of fashionable recently, but when I say lament, I mean like the psalmist, visceral, ugly lament. Lament in the sense of giving your whole body into this experience of It doesn't always look this way, but it often feels very cathartic and intense. But my rule for lament, for engaging the body, is if you feel like you shouldn't say it to God, it's probably the thing you should say or do. That's probably what it would mean to lament in this moment. Running up on time. So I want to close with, this is the white paper. There's some copies available out there. This is a white paper I produced with a clinical social worker, Father Thomas, Mother Liz Gray. She's a mother in the Anglican Church. Something that we all produce, kind of, it's like a little précis or a little small introduction to the book I've been talking to you about. Sexual abuse and trauma safety. There's some copies outside if you want. I want to just present you with some closing thoughts to summarize where we've been going and what we've said. God is love. God is triune. God is incarnate love that gives itself even in violence. We are caught in this violence, but we can become churches and communities that are trauma safe. We really can. It's very simple. And I want to just give you some theses that we wrote out in this white paper to conclude our time. Time does not heal all wounds. The primary pathology of trauma, symptomatically, is avoiding, dissociation. I don't want to think about it. I split off from the experience. I avoid it. Recovery is going to mean naming it. Time by itself doesn't heal anything. We need to engage these stories. Trauma recovery is not linear and does not look like a cure. Most survivors will walk the rest of their life with some kind of limp. And the goal is not to make them fit into the homogenous thing that we expect people or churches to look like. Trauma survivors are gifts to our churches because they show us that wounding comes in all shapes and sizes. And the goal is not cure. The goal is communion with God and with one another. How about this one? Forgiveness is not reconciliation and is not contrary to moral or legal justice. If you want more on this, I invite you to read a chapter in a book I'm editing that's forthcoming later than this one, with a chapter written by Rachel Denhollander, the USA Gymnastics survivor of abuse from Larry Nassar, if you've heard of her. This is something big that her and her husband talk about. Forgiveness doesn't mean being reconciled to someone who's done you wrong. And forgiveness doesn't mean foregoing the claims of justice. What forgiveness is handing over those claims of justice to God and trusting him with it, where earthly means do not suffice. And when someone has committed violence against another, no amount of money actually makes up for it. There's something we have to entrust God with in the eschaton. That's why eschatology is really important. Eschatology is not about, what's the guy who wrote Left Behind and all of that? It's not about calculating numbers. For some reason, when we focus on numbers, theology gets weird, like the Trinity is a math problem and numbers and the eschatology stuff. What eschatology is about is that God's going to make all things new. And we can trust him for justice in the life of the world to come. This is something I already covered. If we prioritize allegiance to the gospel over safety for parishioners, we have misunderstood the gospel. Preaching the message of Christ will never mean endangering others. How could it? You know what I mean? Pursue safety. It's theologically unthinkable that could ever be contrary to the gospel itself. There is no fear in love for trauma safety. If we feel threatened in our institutions by enacting some of these things I'm suggesting, we just have worldly wisdom that's still trying to keep some possession. We don't need to fear. Did you know that 90% of Americans will experience a traumatic event at some point in their lives? I mean proper, like war or a severe accident, life-threatening event, something like that. Only about 8% go on to develop a PTSD diagnosis. What does this tell us? It tells us that trauma is a profoundly subjective experience. Two people can experience the exact same event with the exact same resources, and one is traumatized and another is not. One lives with these post-traumatic, hypervigilant flashback symptoms and triggers, and the other doesn't. Because trauma is about an experience that overwhelms you. So this is where I say, no matter how little or no matter how small something seems to you, you can't put your moral framework on someone else. Because at the end of the day, no matter how much you think they should be more resilient, the fact remains is that their brain broke, is not working, that the trauma happened. Like, you can't put your expectations on other people. The facts are the facts. I want to immediately say trauma symptoms are absolutely normal, and they are not a sign of weakness. They're a sign of strength. They're a sign of our ability to survive overwhelming events. Don't add to the stigmatized identity that survivors feel. Survivors feel like they're ruined. That's exactly what evil wants. This one is important, and we're almost done. Told you I'd have trouble getting through these in time. Sexual abuse is about power, not sex. This is one of the biggest things I would love for all of you to know and carry with you for the rest of your days. The average John who goes out and selects a prostitute, what do we know about him? He's married and has children. He has access to a sexually gratifying relationship. He doesn't go seek out abusive encounters that involve bearing his violence against another sexually because he doesn't have access to sex. It's because sexual abuse is always about degradation. It's the desire to humiliate, however subtle, however slight, it's about the desire to humiliate another because I have power over you and you have no power over me. It's not reciprocal. To use the language of Aquinas, I have union with, not the beloved, the object, but I do not desire their good. That's what sexual abuse is. Always is about power. These are my favorites. There's no trauma with which Christ is not intimately acquainted. I don't mean by that that Christ had PTSD. What I mean by that is what Augustine said. The totus Christus, the whole Christ, is not Christ by himself. It's Christ and his church. Christ is not himself without his body. The head is not complete without its body. Did you know that in Jesus Christ, what God has effectively said to all of us is, I never want to be who I am apart from who you are? The incarnation and the ascension of Christ's body into heaven. Do you ever think, I can't believe I tell my students this, and they look at me like, are you serious? Jesus didn't shed his body when he ascended into heaven? I'm like, am I teaching you a different religion? That's what it feels like. I swear, sometimes late modern American Christianity feels like a different religion to me than what I get to read in all these beautiful people. I don't say that. I say that with joy as a theology professor. But Jesus intimately knows all the trauma of his members because he's one body with his church. What this means is what Jesus said in Matthew 25. Whatever we do to the least, we do to Christ, because he has become one with the least. Jesus has told us very clearly, would you like to find me on earth? I'll tell you exactly where you can find me. You can find me in the homeless person you avoid eye contact with on your way home from work. You can find me in the face of all marginalized and poor and wounded. That's where I am, and if you love them well, you've loved me. And what follows from this is that if one member suffers, we all suffer, because we're all members of one another through the body of Christ. I would love to highlight this for you, maybe as a closing point, is that it's not as if the trauma of other people in the church is something I have to work up empathy for. That's not the truth. The truth is we are united to one another in Christ, and your trauma is my trauma. To the extent I don't recognize it, that's just my lack of recognition of what Jesus has made true by binding us into one body. I've gone over time, so I'll end it with this. All the QR codes you could ever want. I am shamelessly horrible at technology, so Sam and Matt, thank you for helping me with this. If you want to read the article from the other journal, where I'm talking about Jesus doubting God and how great that is for us. Left, middle is book pre-order. for the book. A lot of this content came from the book, Dawn of Sunday, The Trinity and Trauma Safe Churches, that I wrote with my two Anglican buddies internationally. Two Richmond offerings, Doctor of Ministry, inaugural cohort this fall. I'm the director of it. It's going to be amazing. Come apply. We also have with Dr. Youngs and myself and Anna Youngs and others, Richmond Theology and Trauma Certificate Program. And if there are not enough copies of the white paper and you want it, QR code for that as well. Okay. I think that's it. That's all I wanted to bring to you tonight. I wish we had more time. Thank you guys so much for listening and joining.
Thank you, Dr. Hill.